From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Metals manufacturer Allegheny Technologies locked out 2,200 workers in August when the United Steelworkers wouldn't agree to big concessions. Almost 4 months later, the locked out workers are in trouble. Their health benefits ended in November, and Allegheny Technologies is humming with replacement workers. This hour on Point, the Allegheny Technologies lockout and what it tells us about the future of American wages, benefits, and competitiveness. You can join us on air or online where this conversation is always on. Have you felt the bite of wage and benefit concessions? Is this economic dynamism, corporate greed, global competition? Where's the bottom? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Workers worked long and hard to put up one big new plant. When that was over and they put in their 70 and 80-hour weeks, Allegheny Technologies came for concessions. United Steelworkers said no. There was a lockout. Here was a rally in downtown Pittsburgh in September. Steelworkers gathering to protest the lockout, shutting down several streets.
They see you all sticking together, which is our ace in the hole. They know we're going to win.
We're going to win. We are one. We are one. Here, Labor Day Parade in Pittsburgh in September, talking with WTAE, worker Aaron Walter saying, look, it's tough. It's tough when you're locked out. The job's essentially, for the time being, gone.
It's stressful on the kids because I hear them talking about wanting to do things, and they say to each other, well, we can't do it because Daddy doesn't have a job anymore.
Well, if they're going to win, they haven't won yet last week, and this week, still out there, talking with an ABC affiliate early last week. You can hear a couple of the workers still locked out of that big state-of-the-art plant.
So they want to make you work 16 hours on Monday, 16 hours Tuesday, 8 hours Wednesday. There's your 40 hours. Go home for the week.
They also want you to come in for like a morning shift, and then you have to be back at like 6 o'clock that night, you know, go home for a couple hours and then come back.
And that's just the start of the cutbacks that they're asking for, the concessions. With us now from New York is Stephen Greenhouse, visiting researcher at the Russell Sage Foundation, focuses on social sciences, former labor and workplace reporter at the New York Times. He continues to freelance there, and he wrote the piece, The Big Squeeze, Tough Times, or the book, The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. You can link to his big article on Allegheny Technologies and what's happened there at our website, onpointradio.org. Stephen Greenhouse. Steve, welcome back to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Always nice to be here, Tom.
Tell us the story of what happened over the last couple of years and then the lockout. How did this all unfold?
So this is a complicated story. You know, Allegheny Technologies is one of the nation's leading producers of stainless steel, which is kind of a more sophisticated steel that uses nickel. And they wanted to build this, you know, the nation's most sophisticated rolling mill that, you know, that makes thin sheets of metal. So they invested $1.2 billion doing that. And the Steelworkers Union agreed to all sorts of concessions to help them, to encourage them to build that. You know, they agreed to less manning. They agreed to, you know, have all these people work 70, 80 hours a week, maybe 40 hours on their regular shift in the old rolling mill and 40 hours learning to be trained for the new rolling mill. And so the union thought, you know, we're being very cooperative, we're helping them. And then when contract negotiations came up this year, management said, you know, stainless steel prices are really have taken a nosedive. The Chinese are taking more and more of the market. You guys have been nice cooperating with us with concessions, but we need far, far more concessions with you, from you. And they insist, the company insists on a 4-year wage freeze for the current workers and that the current workers pay about $2,000, $3,000 more per year towards their health insurance. And also the company is insisting on a two-tier package where all new hires would have worse compensation, especially on the bottom tier, the new hires would no longer have a good traditional union pension, but would have a much cheaper 401k. They'd have a much worse health plan. And the Steelworkers Union, which is the nation's largest industrial union, and many say the nation's most aggressive, most truculent private sector union, doesn't like two-tier plans, and it balked at accepting it. And once the union balked, the company really locked them out. And the union is, you know, incredibly unhappy about what's happened. They've been locked out now for 4 months, and they say We agreed to concessions.
Yep.
We worked incredibly hard, and we agree you got to be competitive, but what you're demanding goes well beyond what's needed for competitiveness. You're just trying to increase your profits, and it's unfair to us.
Now, you've got the Breckenridge facility that you described being built and how many hours people put in while that was going on. This is a couple dozen miles upstream from Pittsburgh, but the overall lockout is much more widespread than that. 2,200 workers locked out of 12 plants in 6 states. It's one of the country's biggest and longest work stoppages in a long time, you point out, Steve.
Absolutely, Tom. I should have mentioned that. You know, among the states where workers are locked out, New Bedford, Massachusetts, New Britain, Connecticut, just outside Canton, Ohio, Granite City, Illinois, and Oregon. So this affects a lot of communities. And one of the reasons I wrote this story, Tom, was kind of here's this big labor dispute that was just had fallen below the radar. And I think, people talk about what's happening with labor coverage in the United States, and, 30, 40 years ago, a dispute like this would have gotten, tons of ink, tons of coverage, and there was just very little aside from the local press. And the union is, really dug in, and they say, the union insists that they really hurt production by Allegheny Technologies, but, these two sides can't seem to agree on anything. Allegheny Technologies says, oh, production's going as good as usual. And the union says that's bull. They say, we sit outside picketing all day, and we see far fewer trucks coming out with product. And it becomes a question of who's being hurt most, who will cry uncle first. I think the union's big hope, one of its big hopes, is that, and it's going to the National Labor Relations Board, the union argues very strenuously that this is an illegal lockout. And if the NLRB finds that it's an illegal lockout, then the company will be ordered to pay back pay for all the workers ever since the lockout started, going back 15, 16 weeks to August 15th. So I think that's the union's trump card. They hope it works.
For a legal ruling, but that's a big bet with a lot of jobs on the line and a precedent here. Once again, if Allegheny Technologies can break this deal and sort of push it back, Allegheny Technologies says, look, these are very well-paid workers, too well-paid for the new global competition that we face. What about what people have been making here, Steve, and what's envisioned by the company for the future?
Good question. So no one will deny that the workers are well-paid, but...
What does that mean? Put a number on it.
So Allegheny Technologies says the workers are paid, receive about $70 an hour, including benefits and including overtime.
So everything in their pension, health coverage, everything.
Pensions, health coverage, overtime.
Vacation.
Vacation, everything. The union says that's just not true. That's vastly exaggerated. Under the contract, the union workers' base wage is $24.99, about a third of what the company says the workers are earning. And with incentive pay and with and with pensions and everything, the union says, our pay might come to $40 an hour, $45 an hour. So there's a huge difference. And the company trumpets the high number to try to, score public relations points and put the union on the defensive. The union says it's just not true. And one of the hard things to do, and the company says, our flat rolling division is losing money, largely because of the Chinese and our high labor costs, and they say we've got to get these labor costs under control. And the union says, the company is doing fine, thank you, we're just going through a temporary downturn, so you don't have to demand, a pound of flesh from us, because, this is a volatile market, clearly steel prices will go up again, so don't demand two huge concessions from us. And the question, as often happens in these bitter labor disputes, Tom, is how does one begin to get to yes when the two sides are so far apart?
When the company is saying we're not destroying the middle class here. They're saying these aren't middle class workers. They're calling them upper middle class, looking at some who in those couple of years where they were running both plants and working 80-hour weeks, some who made $100,000. Saying,
I interviewed some of these workers, and they worked, 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. every day or 7 p.m. to 7 a.m. every day. And they said, yes, we made upper middle class wages because we were working this freakish year where we were working double shift many days, 16 hours many days.
Which they saw in a way as an investment for the company, for the future.
Yes. So we were making a lot of money, yes, but we hardly saw our family. We didn't have a life. And it's kind of the company is being unfair, saying, you made $94,000 a year, $100,000 a year, and the workers say, yeah, we only made that money, that much money because we were bending over backwards, doing the company a big favor by working these double shifts. So the workers are really extra angry about that. And the workers say, you know, we'd love to go back to a more normal life, you know, no more 70 and 80 hour weeks, and let's have 40 or 50 hour weeks. And one of the big points is, when the workers say we want to return to middle class life, it's not only on wages, but it's on having a regular schedule so you could have a good family life,
yeah.
Have dinner with the family. And the company wants much more flexibility in assigning workers and to maintain the right somewhat to, you know, schedule very flexibly and have people work 70 hour a week.
When does this come to a head? It's getting cold. It's going to be winter. People don't have health insurance already. They haven't had a regular income. It's stretching out now almost 4 months. I don't know where the legal angle stands. When does this come to a head?
So I worked with a terrific photographer on the story, Tom Johnson. He took photos over a 2 week period, and he said, you know, when he went back earlier this week, you know, 2 weeks after he first went to Breckenridge to photograph, he said the workers are getting a lot more anxious, a lot more depressed because, you know, two more weeks without pay, their health benefits are cut off on November 30th. You know, Christmas is approaching, colder weather is approaching. In February, all the workers will lose their unemployment benefits. And people are anxious, and there's no specific deadline. This could go on for a long, long time, Tom. You know, I think the union, as I said, hopes their, you know, ace in the hole would be this NLRB lawsuit, but that is iffy. And the company thinks that it has the upper hand. It thinks that it's, getting the workers closer to surrender. And the whole question is, who could outlast the other?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a big showdown over American wages in steel country right now. Workers locked out since August, trying to hang on to good wages and a middle-class life. It's with Allegheny Technologies is the company, and a great big plant went up in Breckenridge, Pennsylvania, a couple dozen miles upriver from Pittsburgh for a rolling mill there. Stainless steel. So this is supposed to be the future, they told everybody. But once the plant was ready to go, they offered cutbacks and two tiers and all kinds of concessions. United Steelworkers said, no, they're locked out. They've got replacement workers in there. Signs all around saying scabs, danger, scabs trying to run mills, scabs equal dishonor. But it's rolling. And the workers are locked out of 12 plants now, 2,200 workers. Another one of these stories about American wages headed on. The company says this has to be done to stay competitive. Steve Greenhouse has been writing it up for the New York Times. He joins us today from New York, author of The Big Squeeze, Tough Times for the American Worker. You can join us. Where are your sympathies here? With the workers trying to hang on to a good solid wage, with the owners saying they're just trying to stay competitive. Do you trust the bosses that this is about competing, not about lining their pockets, making them richer? Do the workers sound realistic, fair in their demands? Back in August, when it was warmer and the lockout was new, it was WTAE Television talking with picketing workers in Breckenridge, Pennsylvania.
I just don't like it. I mean, we're doing what we can out here to picket, to support all the union brothers and sisters.
And now they're kicking us out on the streets, and that's what we get, you know, for that. You know, we're fighting tooth and nail over there trying to get the new strip mill going.
More and more hours being asked. Here was Bob Kulik picketing outside Allegheny Technologies in August, again with WTAE.
The amount of hours they want to force us to work without extra pay, not be able to spend any time with our families because we'll be in here working all of these hours.
Steve Greenhouse, please stand by. A couple more voices here from New York. Kate Bond joins us, economist at the Center for American Progress. Kate, thank you very much for being here.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
And with us from Hanover, New Hampshire is Matthew Slaughter, Dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College, also professor there of international business. Dean Slaughter, Matthew Slaughter, thank you very much for being here today.
Thanks very much, Tom.
Kate, what do you see going on here? Step back from the details. Is this yesterday's battle? This is already lost. This is in the rearview mirror. This is hopeless, or is this important, or both?
I think this is really important. I think you know, what we've seen over this trend in the U.S. is declining unionization, declining rates of unions, and rising inequality. We know that unions have been the backbone of the American middle class, and as we've seen them decline, we've seen the American middle class hollow out. And so we see struggles like this and fights like this as really the place to sort of push back against these trends and make sure that we are, you know, promoting policies that are pro-workers, which is, you know, the key piece of that is making sure we have a strong American labor movement and you know, active union members doing things like this.
What do you see here, Matthew Slaughter, when the company says we have to have a different labor deal in order to be competitive in the global market? Does that sound credible to you?
It is credible. I think the example of Allegheny Technologies is very representative of how these global companies connected to the world through international trade investment really are sort of the canaries in the coal mine for the competitive pressures and the creative destruction that globalization creates. The data show quite clearly that companies that are able to succeed when they're connected to the world tend to be very innovative, tend to have good jobs at high and rising wages. The data are very clear on that for exporters, for companies that are part of a multinational company. And yet, those that don't thrive, well, they don't. And it speaks to what Kate just mentioned, which is the reality in the American labor force for a long time is a lot of American workers and their families are struggling. And though globalization overall and innovation generate very large gains, those gains aren't equally shared across every worker and firm and community. So when Steve earlier says, how do we get to yes, I think that's a really important framing for this issue. Somehow having companies and their workers, and ideally the public sector, find a way to help those who aren't directly benefiting from these competitive pressures, I think that's central.
Kate, how do we get to the truth here? The company says this realignment of wages and benefits is absolutely necessary for us to be competitive. You've got union people saying, come on, the company's just going to make extra profit here. They can ride this out with us. They don't need to break the wage structure. This is about lining their pockets, not about staying competitive. How does the truth of that debate get settled, Kate?
Well, the way I see it is, you know, the United States labor market is never going to be competing on low labor costs. That's just not the market we're competing in. We're going to be competing on high quality goods. And so the way we do that is by having a robust labor market with fair paid workers who are going to be more productive, as these workers have been when they were asked to contribute more to getting this new plant up to speed. They did that. They worked a lot more. They were paid their fair union wages while doing that. And they're clearly very invested in the competitive ability of this company. Yep. They've said as much.
So still, the argument is the company's saying stainless steel prices are down. China's pumping it out. We built this new plant. If we want it to stay healthy and competitive, you can't have the packages you once had. How do we know if that's true, that really doesn't add up?
Well, I mean, Steve's article said that it's destined to be just a temporary dip in the steel prices. And also when we're looking at it, the actual numbers is that this one new plant they built employs 23 union workers, and they're locking 2,200 people out. So where are these other almost 2,200 people who are working in these other plants? We need to maintain our productivity at these other plants. And the way we do that is through having, you know, fair wages leading to efficiency wages for workers who are going to work harder. They're very invested in it, and they're going to ensure that these companies are going to be both very productive and very efficient, and then therefore more competitive on the global labor market.
We're going to hear from
the global product market.
We will hear from United Steelworkers in a few minutes here. We invited Allegheny Technologies. No response from them. Steve Greenhouse, what about the truth of these competing claims about where the saved money would go and the necessity of it? Is this about staying competitive? Is this about bigger returns for management and shareholders in Allegheny Technology?
I think it's both. And, you know, the company has been, you know, its flat roll division has been losing money largely because of the Chinese. The one thing that the company and the union agree on is that the Chinese are, you know, are illegally underpricing on steel products, and they want the Obama administration to crack down on that. And they praise each other on cooperating on that. You know, the company, you know, its flat rolling division has lost money 10 out of the last 11 quarters. It says it needs a significant decrease in labor costs. The union says, yeah, we'll help you. You know, the union in the negotiations agreed to absorb more of the health costs. It agreed to reduce incentive pay somewhat and said, we are helping out. We are trying to cooperate to reduce costs, but you guys are asking too much, and you're not just worried about increasing competitiveness. You're trying too hard to increase profits. And one thing that really sticks in the union's craw is that last year, the CEO of Allegheny Technologies Technologies, Richard Harshman, increased his pay or had his pay increased 70% to $8 million a year from $4.7 million. And you can imagine what the unionized workers are saying, that how could you ask us for such huge concessions when, you know, the big boss, the CEO, you know, thinks that things are so good, that the company's doing so well, that he warrants a 70% raise. And that, you know, even some Wall Street analysts say that was really dumb for the company to do right at the moment it was going to demand such big concessions.
We're going to hear from Tom Conway with United Steelworkers in just a moment. A couple of callers first, Grand Rapids. John is calling. John, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I want to get to your question of trust in a moment, because that's really what this all boils down to. But I think a little look at history of how we got here. Reagan busted the air traffic controller union in the 80s. And if you could go back into the 80s and look at all these strikes that have occurred since, and one of them, I remember well the Austin, Minnesota Hormel strike. This has been nothing but union budgets and busting and wages dropping for 30, 40 years now. Have CEO wages gone down? And that's a rhetorical question, because we all know that that's not true. We also in Wisconsin have a similar situation where public employees lost their union rights. Do you think the public knows how many wage cuts they took? They think it was all about retirement benefits.
So what do you see going on here, John? Bottom line.
It's class warfare. It's a shift of money going from the bottom to the top. Simple as that.
Let me hold that and get one more, if I may. John, thank you. Jimmy in Enterprise, Alabama. Jimmy, you're on the air. Hello, Jimmy. Are you there, my friend? Well, let's go to Clifton Springs, New York, and Brian. Brian, thanks. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you. I'm just a regular guy, but I agree with the previous caller. And I'm going to use a word that I heard off of one of the NPR programs from last night, and that is a scab. And we need to stick together, the average working blue-collar guys and gals. And I really don't understand why people, the average workers, don't like unions. They work for the workers. They get generally better wages and benefits. And I think that's what everybody needs right now. We need to stick together and try to go down that road.
Brian, we've got it. I appreciate your call as well. Let's go to Pittsburgh and Thomas Conway, International VP for United Steelworkers. He has overseen the bargaining with Allegheny Technologies. Tom Conway, welcome to On Point. Thanks for being here.
Okay, good to be with you.
Do you still have a chance in this? It's almost 4 months now. That's a long time. That's got to be tough for your members.
Of course we have a chance. And frankly, we're going to win this thing.
Are you going to win it in negotiation or in the courts?
Well, we'll win it in both places if we need to. These things aren't won on picket lines. Our members are holding strong on a picket line, and they're furious about what this company is doing to them and doing to their families.
What about?
So it'll be tough, but they will get through this, and we'll all come through this together. And so if the company thinks they're going to break these people by treating them this way, they're just mistaken, and they're putting their risk, and they're putting their shareholders, and they're putting their company at risk at a time when the company and or the workforce can least afford it. I mean, no one denies that we have a lot of pressure here from China, but their demands would reach into 3 decades from now, 30 years, 35 years from now. Someone who retires cannot expect any support from the company. They don't want to provide them with a guaranteed defined benefit pension. They want to leave them out on the stock market. And we've dealt with those before, and we could deal with it. They don't want to provide them any form of insurance when they're done with them. They don't want to provide them life insurance. So if there's a Chinese crisis today in pricing, trying to deal with things 35 years from now is not the answer. And the union has recognized that there are ongoing health care cost issues and agreed to share a portion of that, have recognized that we can make some adjustments in incentive packages along the way, have agreed to a number of things that the company wanted, but they've just sort of got this in their head that we now have this opportunity. We can't let this crisis go unused. We're going to blame it all on China and chase these wages down. And this is going on across our country. And we're in the midst of a big discussion in America. Should we do another Trans-Pacific Partnership with 12 nations?
Yeah.
And continue this decline in America's living standard? We're never going to work at this at the wage level of the Chinese. And saying to someone, "Well, I'm going to now charge you 300-400% more for your monthly health care with an out-of-pocket maximum that's $4,000-$6,000. You effectively won't have health care because I have to compete with China." It's just ridiculous. I mean, we're just at a point where things need to sort of come to some common sense. And here we have a greedy boss running a company who thinks he can just, he made a remark one time that he didn't think his company could be so paternalistic. And I mentioned it in Steve's article. I mean, this isn't paternalism. These are people who work very hard, very, very long hours, week after week after week without a break, don't see their families.
Yeah.
And to think that he's providing them something out of the goodness of his heart is just an arrogance that's unbelievable.
Tom Conway, let me get a caller here from Detroit. Jamal is calling. Jamal, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
What do you think?
I can't speak to the specifics and details of the plans and the unions.
Yeah.
But I'm going to speak more on the macro. The poor, the working class, the middle class, like one of the previous people said, they've been under assault for 30, 40 years. The CEOs, the companies, they've grown. We need to stop our 19th and 20th century mentality of being workers. That's the modern day serf. That's the modern day slave. We need to become more entrepreneurialistic. We need to think of ourselves as enterprises. There are people who spend their entire lives working for a company, and in their obituary, that's what they're remembered as. They sacrifice their time, their talents, their relationships for someone who at the drop of a dime will tell them China, Mexico, Taiwan, Mars, making them cut back. We need to invest in ourselves and in our communities.
Jamal, let me take it to Tom Conway, who's the union VP here. Tom, you hear Jamal. I mean, he's ready to check out of the whole dynamic. People can't see themselves as workers. Everybody has to be an entrepreneur. Now, that's just the way it is.
Now, look, I think some people are suited to that and some aren't. And some people, frankly, just want to go to work, do their 8 hours, do a good job, collect their paycheck, and go about the rest of their lives. Not everybody in this country lives to work. For folks who want to be entrepreneurial, look, we understand that. And we think the strength of our nation is the combination of capital and labor working together and making a product and manufacturing a product and taking to a market and selling it. And we think America's lost its way on its manufacturing basis. It has shipped it all offshore. It thinks we're going to make an economy out of financial services. And frankly, we believe if you don't mine, mill something, put capital, put labor against it, value add it, and take it to a market, your economy is sort of a sham. You can't continue to make money off of increasing ATM fees.
Yeah, on the other hand, Steve Greenhouse says that the flat rolling division of Allegheny lost money in 10 out of the last 11 quarters. That doesn't sound sustainable either.
No, it doesn't sound sustainable. It is a problem. And I think it's a problem that a lot of companies in this nation are facing over the globalization and the continued chasing of work offshore. And you'll hear a lot of talk about, well, there's new onshoring going on and people are bringing back manufacturing jobs. But they're bringing them back at $12.50 and $13 and $14 an hour. They're not at the kind of family-sustaining wages that they need to be at. And so if America is accepting of the fact that all of our work, all of our manufacturing bases can be done somewhere else, and we're just going to sell computer programs to each other, we think that's a fallacy, and we think that's not what the majority of this country believes is the right approach for it.
Thomas Conway, International Vice President, United Steelworkers. Tom, thanks for being with us today from Pittsburgh.
All right. Thank you.
We invited Allegheny Technologies on. No reply. Matthew Slaughter at the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College. Please stand by. Kate Vaughn at the Center for American Progress. Steve Greenhouse. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
On Point is sponsored by Casper, an online retailer of premium mattresses made in America. They're engineered for comfort and long-lasting support with just the right sink, just the right bounce. Two technologies, latex foam and memory foam, come together for better nights and brighter days. It's outrageous comfort at a polite price. Here's the great part. You can try one risk-free for 100 days with free delivery and returns. Go to casper.com/onpoint. That's casper.com/onpoint. And remember to use promo code ONPOINT at checkout to receive a special offer. Terms and conditions apply.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a big showdown over American wages in steel country right now. Workers locked out since August, trying to hang on to good wages and a middle-class life. Steve Greenhouse is writing up the whole story of Allegheny Technologies and the lockout there. Brackenridge, Pennsylvania, at the heart of his report, but it's 2,200 workers over 12 plants, six states. He's author of The Big Squeeze, joins us today from New York. Matthew Slaughter is here, dean of the Tuck School of Business at Dartmouth College, also professor of international business. And Kate Bond is with us, economist at the Center for American Progress. What do you see here? In a country where the rich have done so well, is there nothing that decently paid middle-class workers can count on here? Or has your boss made it clear you're expendable if you don't take what you're offered? What about the competitiveness argument? Stainless steel prices are down. No profit in 10 out of the 11 quarters. Lost money. What's fair? What's right and smart? Matthew, Kate, Steve, I want to, online here, people are responding. Lots of folks. Wanda says, I can't get over how management with a straight face asks workers to take cuts while increasing their salaries by 1,000%. Well, it wasn't 1,000, but it was big, up to 8 million there. There's certainly bigger out there, but that's a big jump. John says, look, former leader of the AFL-CIO once said the only answer to organized greed is organized labor. But Jeff said, isn't this just an issue with iron and steel nationwide? Prices are down, industry's changing. Perhaps it's time to close down inefficient plants, and these workers may have to find jobs in other industries. But Matthew Slaughter, this plant just opened up. It was supposed to be state-of-the-art. I mean, if getting more sophisticated, we're told, is the way for Americans to compete and maintain wages, how do you do that if the very newest plant out there isn't sophisticated enough?
That's a great question, and it speaks to how dynamic and quick-changing the global economy can be. China as a country overall, is they're trying to reorient their economy away from exporting as much to the rest of the world as away from building as many buildings and factories. They're producing a tremendous amount of steel in recent years, and that's a big part of what's driving down world prices. And it's China today, but almost surely tomorrow and in the years beyond, it will be India. It will be Brazil when it might recover. We now have billions of people that are acceding into the global economy with a lot of the same hopes and dreams that Americans have. And the reality is, if we can find a way for business and labor in the United States to acknowledge the facts, and importantly, I think one of the things I'll stress here is for the public sector to play a role. There's a lot of public policies that could be put into place for a more robust, broader social safety net in America to speak to these challenges that, as some of the earlier callers rightly pointed out, are pervasive across the U.S. economy
but
today.
I don't think these workers want a stronger safety net. They don't want better unemployment. I mean, by definition, that's not going to be a great living. They want a strong job with strong pay. Is that too much to hope for? And Matthew Slaughter, speak to the issue of executive compensation or the way that wealth and income has drifted up while middle class has drifted down. Do we just need to somehow reallocate the money? Because clearly a lot of people at the – I mean, it's a small percentage, but there's a bunch of folks up there at the top. They're doing real well.
The reallocation is definitely an important issue that you point out. When you look in recent months, in fact, in recent years in the U.S. economy, there's an amazing amount of churn in the U.S. labor market every month. So last month, for example, that we have the most recent data on, there were almost 5 million job separations in the U.S. economy last month. It was about 4.8 million. That works out to about 30,000 every hour that America is open for business.
Job separation, like jobs that go away or people that lose their job?
That's right. So it's some involuntary separations, okay. And sometimes it's people quitting to move on to other jobs themselves.
Yep.
But the point is there's just a tremendous amount of dynamism in the U.S. economy that's been present for a long time. One of the forces driving that is innovation and technological change. Another is competition with the rest of the world. And again, what ideally is going to happen in the United States, and Tom, the union vice president, correctly pointed out, with the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade negotiation, these issues are going to be in the forefront for America for a long time. And I think the right perspective is not to say we can stop innovation, we can stop globalization, but rather what sorts of public policies can we put in place with sound trade investment agreements and with a stronger, more robust social safety net to address the concerns. I agree that lots of people legitimately want to have a good job with a good paycheck. Those jobs simply can't be guaranteed for years and years. And importantly, with a stronger social safety net, we'll have a better way to accommodate those people who aren't directly benefiting from these forces.
But people don't want to just be ushered politely and nicely and comfortably to a lower standard of living. You can't blame them for that. So what's the answer?
Great question. Over a long time horizon, the answer is we as a country, I think, need to make stronger and smarter investments in things like our infrastructure, in our public education system at the primary and secondary levels, with greater access to college education and different levels of trade school beyond high school. There's a whole set of policies that ideally raise the productivity of American workers. That's an issue whether we have a lot of global competition or we have no global competition at all. And so some of the challenges that we're seeing with these companies, as I said a bit earlier, sort of being the canary in the coal mine, they're underscoring some of the challenges in America's economic policy that are present, whether or not the rest of the world is growing or not.
Kate Bond, do you see this demand for concessions and the lockout as just opportunistic? There was a moment where they felt the leverage. That's what the union VP had to say. Or do you see it as a company legitimately fighting for global competitiveness so that that big, shiny new plant doesn't go out of business?
I mean, I see it completely opportunistic on the part of the company. It's very similar to what we saw with American Airlines filing for bankruptcy when they had a lot of money in the bank and they were just trying to sort of defer their pension payments. And I think it's really important to sort of get back to why this is relevant for everyone in the American economy. So we brought up that it's important for the American economy to be growing, to be competitive, but really the way that we're going to see these things happening is by having a strong labor movement that, you know, the idea of having a social safety net that would be good for everyone, how are we going to get these policies across without a labor movement pioneering these sorts of policies that help all people? We know that a labor movement is associated with establishing more progressive policy that's better for all workers, not only the union members themselves. And so it has spillover effects that not only union members are making good wages, but in areas with high union density, other people are making good wages. We know that they're going to have a better and more secure retirement if they have an access to a defined benefit pension plan rather than these 401k defined contribution plans that the company is trying to get these second tier contracts for newer workers to have. And then there's these long-term effects of having a strong labor movement and having people have good wages. We know that there's a higher chance of intergenerational mobility in union households. So we know that things like children who have a non-college educated father who's a union member will earn 30% more than a child who grows up with a non-college educated father who's not in a union. And so when we're talking about the health of the American economy and the reason it's important for the American economy to have things like competitive companies and high productivity, unions, I think, are really a crucial part of having long-term sustainable economic growth in the U.S. with broadly shared gains, not just for corporations.
I mean, you may be right, but holy smokes. I mean, defined benefit pension plan for an awful lot of Americans, that's deep in the rearview mirror. Sounds like another age. They've still got it. John in Detroit, Michigan. John, you're on the air.
Thanks, Tom. Well, your guest was just speaking to a lot of what I believe in as a union member and the physical responsibility. You know, we've given up wages for 30 years to have a pension, so we're not reliant, and so we can put money into the economy when we're old and decrepit. But what I originally called about is, you know, what we're talking about here is modern day slavery, and that's the business plan for corporations is to. You know, $8 million for the president, and you know they got to move out of the country or fire all their union help. That's just ridiculous. No one needs $8 million a year. That's just outrageous. And this is part of the problem with the world peace situation. You know, world peace is partially a military solution, but the real solution is economics, and that's the bottom line.
Slave labor. It's a tall charge. Steve Greenhouse, how does that fit your ear? You write sympathetically about labor. Do you see slave labor at some fundamental dynamic here?
I think if, you know, I were the CEO of Allegheny Technologies right now and someone said I'm engaged in slave labor, he'd say, what are you talking about? We pay these people, you know, they say $70 an hour, even if you say $40 yep. an hour with benefits, they could say those aren't slaves, those people do fine. And you know, the big issue now is, you know, this company is losing money and it says we need concessions. And they say, the company says we need a whole lot of concessions. And the union says, no, you don't. You're going way too far. You're being greedy. You want to, you know, be able to increase the CEO's bonus to 10, you know, that's his compensation to $10 million next year from $8 million next yep. year. And it's a bridge too far, you're asking.
But I think it's the equity issue our caller points to. When equity goes out the window, even if they're being paid $40 an hour, it can look like, you know, all the choices, all the option, all the freedom is available to the top. At the bottom, it's like, take what we give you.
Well, I mean, so the caller had, you know, I think made a good point in that, you know, the dynamic of labor relations over the past 20, 30 years in the U.S. is management is trying to tell the workers, you know, you got to take these concessions because we're in an increasingly globalized market and we can no longer afford to pay you the $25, $30, $35, $40 an hour right now. There's a big labor dispute right now in Wisconsin. Kohler, the big plumbing fixtures yeah. company making, you know, so the workers there, 2,000 workers have been on strike for almost a month because the company wants to maintain a two-tier contract with the bottom tier manufacturing workers making just around $12.50 an hour. And the union says we've got to get rid of two tiers just as we did with the UAW contract. And the company says if the union forces us to get rid of a second tier, we're going to move this production overseas. And, as Matt was saying, you know, we're a much more globalized world. We're competing with workers in India and China and many other countries. So these big companies say we have to squeeze down wages to compete. And workers say, unions say, you're squeezing us too far. Your profits are very high. You shouldn't be squeezing us nearly as much as you are.
It would be more believable if the pain was more evenly shared. But it doesn't exactly look that way. Let's go to Kohler country, maybe. Chris is calling from Wisconsin. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, in the first place, I just want to say that the Kohler company was the scene of the longest and one of the most violent strikes in the history of America. That's the first thing. The Kohlers, this is a family-owned business. It's not publicly traded.
And there's a strike going on now, right, Chris?
There's a strike going on now. And I just wanted to say that these jobs are hard, dirty, tiring jobs. It's not like they're having cushy land
yep.
donated out
yep.
to them.
All that beautiful plumbing stuff, it doesn't come out of no effort.
No, foundries.
Yep.
Foundries.
Yep.
And I just wanted to say that Herb Kohler has this magnificent golf course that he built called Whistling Straits, and the PGA finals were there, and wants to build a second golf course, but he can't pay his workers. And it's not necessary. It's unlike Michigan. It's an environmental catastrophe. And he wants to access the golf course through a state park. And there's a concerted effort by the community to try and stop this, but they're fighting big politics here. And I just think that these people get all kinds of political favors in addition to running these companies. And I just want to say that the American public should boycott Kohler products until they settle that strike.
Chris, we've got a little power imbalance there, maybe. Thank you for your call. One more, Rowley, Massachusetts. Danby, you're on.
Hi. I read an article on the Boston Globe from December 2nd talking about the board of directors people are making like $100,000 a meeting or millions and millions of dollars a year. How much are the Allegheny people making in the board of directors? I mean, when you compare that to making $100,000 a year, which is base pay.
Working 70 or 80 or 80 hours a week
yeah.
during the period when that happened. Steve, how about it?
I confess, I don't know exactly how much the Allegheny Technologies board members make, but you know, as the caller said, a lot of board members make $20,000, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 a meeting. And again, if you're a worker who's being asked to take a 4-year wage freeze or pay much more for your health coverage, you're going to say, "This is unfair. Those people are living high on the hog. They get paid as much to go to a meeting as I get paid all year. Something's wrong here." And then that's part of the underlying dynamic that fuels lengthy you know, labor disputes like this is, you know, capital thing. You know, a lot of businesses think workers have it too good, and the workers think that's bull. We're straining. You know, we're trying to get by on 40, 50, 60,000 a year. That's not rich. And while those, you know, the 1% is doing very, very well, and I think that's, you know, we're seeing that played out in the presidential elections too, where, you know, the two parties have very different views on what should be done for workers and what should be done for the 1%. And that's one of the big questions that we face in America today, you know, how to try to create more equity for workers while maintaining a highly competitive society.
Matthew Slaughter, you say strengthen the safety net to make it easier for workers to deal with dislocation, losing jobs. There may be some right here. Steelworkers Union says, no, we're going to win, but that is not clear, and it's getting cold out there. They want a two-tier thing. We're in the future. Compensation is just not as good. Do Americans have to accept that as the future for their children, for the country, Matt?
I don't think we have to. I think two things have to happen. One, though, is we need to find the political voice to find the will for public policies that are going to provide some support for these pressures. And there are opportunities, too. Again, as I said earlier in the conversation, the companies that succeed most in the global economy, those are ones that thrive. They tend to pay much higher wages than average in the private sector. They're good jobs at good wages. I think the policy question is, how can we create more companies like that? And a second point I'll make related to this really important question, it harkens back to one of Steve's insights a minute ago. Mm-hmm. Some of the strongest companies in America, I think, are the ones where they have leaders that voice a vision that inspires all the stakeholders from the newest hire on the production line level all the way up to the board members that are helping run the company. A good example, I think, of that is Howard Schultz recently at Starbucks with what they're doing to provide college education access for some of their basic entry workers.
Vision's great. On the other hand, at a certain point, you can't eat vision. Kate, are you optimistic that the steel workers will win here?
I am optimistic. I think I see labor movement doing a good job of framing this, of fighting back, of making everyone sort of realize that we're all in this together, that it's important to have high-paying, secure jobs.
And Steve, quickly, if they win, could this big new plant close down?
Now, this is an amazingly modern, sophisticated plant. I don't see it closing. It's really, you know, one of the most sophisticated plants in the world, and the company's trying to figure out a way, how do we move forward with this plant and make it profitable? And as I said, the union is saying, you know, they're demanding too large, too, you know.
Let's hope it all works. Steve Greenhouse, Kate Bond, Matthew Slaughter, our thanks to each of you. Thank you very much. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Mm-hmm.